I'm calling the June 4th meeting of the Writers Advisory Council to order, and we do have a quorum. Are there any public comments at this time?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And now, I usually ride the front call of each train, and as I was riding the front call, I've been noticing that the train operator uses the full length of the station to stop the train, even for those six car trains. And I'd like to propose an idea that Metro workers install distance markers. For example, with the number six on it, to mark the absolute minimum distance required for the train to stop.
Can you speak direct? I'm having difficulty understanding what you're saying. I think the first part of what you said is I heard that you said you were usually ride the front car of every train.
Correct.
And I thought you then said that the Metro operator calls out the full station name?
Easy. The Metro operator uses the full length of the station to stop the train to ensure all the open doors are within the length of the station.
Okay, so are you saying that whether it's a six or eight car train, that the train should stop in such a way that all the doors open within the station boundaries and not go?
He's saying they should open in the middle of the platform instead of going to the end.
Yeah, okay. These were six car trains.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
Sure.
And you had a second point, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and all the stations are roughly the, all the stations are pretty much the same length, because it's pretty much eight cars long. And I was saying for those six-car trains, they should stop in the middle of the station.
Okay.
Which could possibly save travel time off the lines.
Okay. Thank you very much. Could you fill out the public comment form so we have a record of your name, and we need to get back to you for follow-up? I would like to do that.
Certainly. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Are there any more public comments? Kurt.
Just for the record, the reason for the full length stops is because there were a bunch of incidents involving trains opening doors off the platform, and so a directive was issued that all trains six or eight cars long have to make a full length stop. Of course, this will all go away with a return to automatic train operation, which should hopefully also entail a return to automatic door control, but nobody seems to know with a firm date when that will happen. I also wanted to mention, because fare policy is on the agenda, just broadly, I would ask the RAC to remain open-minded in considering the issue of fare policy. It's something that's gotten sort of very entrenched at WMATA, and there are these sort of knee-jerk, dogmatic, we can't do X or we can't do Y type responses. And I would just say, please try to consider things in terms of, benchmarking against other transit agencies and really keeping an open mind instead of just looking at the existing fare structures and saying, what little tweak can we make here or there? This is really something to look at the sort of the broader universe of transit and see what other transit systems are doing instead of saying, well, we've been doing this for 35 years and it's worked well enough. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further public comment? Can we then move on to the approval of the agenda? And I apologize that I need to put two things on the agenda, but we'll do that after the presentations. One is a vote to change the date of the July meeting from July 2nd to July 9th. And the second is a vote to collapse the Safety and Security Committee, which we established two meetings ago, into the Customer Services Committee. We'll take care of that after the presentations, but I want to add that to the agenda. Maybe on item 8, chair report, which also should say other updates. It's just, it's not just my time to blather. Okay. Is that agreeable with people? So I'm just going to assume consent and not take a vote on that. Next item is the approval of the past minutes. I will say this, that within a few days of our April, of our May meeting, the RAC leadership team had both the April and May meetings. We reviewed them. Some minor edits were made. You got the minutes sent to you on Friday, which should have given ample time to review them. So I would like to entertain a motion to have the agenda, the minutes approved, both for April 2nd and May 7th. Is there a motion? A second? Discussion? Call the question. All in favor of approving those minutes? Thank you. And I want to begin by thanking Lynn Barisox and her staff who are here to give a presentation on the impact of the, that will help us work on our priority of the impact of the Silver Line, particularly on other lines. Lynn has to leave by 7:30. I don't want to take up any more of her time, so I'm turning it over to her right now. Thank you, Lynn. And that's fine, or...
Thank you to the chair and the Writers Advisory Council members for having me back. It's always good to see y'all. And I just want to introduce my colleague, Jim Hughes, whom you've met before, I think. Jim has been a leader in service planning and operational planning here at WMATA for, how many years?
18
years. So the Silver Line, the original planning for the Silver Line probably predates him, but not much has gone on with the Silver Line of any substance that has not been touched by or influenced by Jim Hughes in some way. So while I want to walk you through a little bit, at the chair's request, the marketing that we're doing around the Silver Line and the impacts, benefits, and otherwise to folks on other lines, I know that some of you have some operational questions too, and so Jim is here to help address those in any way that we can. All right? So with that, let me first see if you have the handouts that we provided. Okay, and you also have bags with collateral materials in them that are going to be circulated if you don't have them already. I want you to have copies of the information that we're giving to our riders, our customers. The staff have it, and they're going to send it around the room. Okay? So let me just start by saying that some of you may have heard a board presentation I made last September when I said that awareness of the Silver Line was markedly not yet high. And it was at that time about 50% of the region who knew of the Silver Line. In November, we tested that again, and it had inched up to about 60% of regional residents. And we tested it again just last week, and it's gone much, much higher. And today, excuse me, we have about 90% of the region having heard of the Silver Line, knowing it's of existence. And in Northern Virginia, that number is about 95%. And that's important to us because the original ridership forecast assumed that 100% of those who could possibly decide to take the Silver Line would know about it before we started it. So we are approaching that level of awareness, and that's a positive for us. It means that we then have to communicate a lot of information to people about the Silver Line, where it goes, what it does, and that's what we've been up to. Even among the riders who were aware of the project being constructed, there has been confusion about station locations and the fact that the Silver Line was being built in two phases. In fact, many wrongly believed that it would go to Dulles Airport in the first phase. And there's no great mystery about that. The project has been called the Dulles Rail Project, right? And it abuts the Dulles Toll Road. And there are a lot of things in the Dulles corridor. And so when you talk about the project's construction, the word Dulles finds its way in there all the time. And so it's natural to assume that that project name is indicative of a destination, and it will be eventually, but not today, not this summer. The phase one of the project only goes as far as Reston East, Wheelie Avenue, and so we have some education of folks to do to make sure that nobody boards that train thinking they're going to the airport. The good news is we have other conveyances that do, many great bus connections and bus services, and we'll be able to get them there. during the winter and early spring, we did a significant amount of outreach to increase awareness and inform future and current customers about the basics of the Silver Line, connecting Wheelie Reston East and Largo Town Center at the two terminuses, making all downtown stops in the district, connecting the entire region to new opportunities for employment, entertainment, and shopping. And if you look at this next slide, you will see, and I'm sort of letting this out in public, the way my staff has come to memorize the five new Silver Line stations. We use My Tiger Grows Shiny Whiskers, MTGSW, as our way to remember the new stations on the line. And so we've been encouraging people in among our employees who are learning the new system to use that that moniker to help recall the line. If you go to the next slide, you can see that from November through the end of last month, we participated in more than 80 neighborhood festivals and events throughout the region, such as the Taste of Arlington, Reston Founders Day, and the Women of Prince George's Conference, and we hosted booths at large regional events that attract as many as 200,000 attendees, like the NBC4 Health and Fitness Expo and the Washington Auto Show. I will tell this group that I don't recall which of the RAC members it was, but there was a member who last summer when I was here suggested we go to more community events and activities to reach out. And it was a good suggestion, and we took it, and we have found that to be a very effective way to meet people where they are and where they're looking for information. And there's a tremendous amount of excitement in these communities when they come up to our booth and they're looking for information, and it's a great opportunity for us to talk one-on-one with folks. So that has been a real benefit. During the holiday season, we went out to the malls and displayed large two-story Silver Line shopping banners, at shopping centers, Tyson's Corner Mall and Prince George's Plaza, and that was a great awareness builder. And of course, those shopping centers have a lot of traffic over the holidays. And this past school year, we visited nearly every high school within a four-mile radius of the new Silver Line stations, as well as many elementary and middle schools along the line. And we went to PTA meetings and school assemblies, as well as lunch and learn events, and provided safety information and Silver Line rider materials to students and parents. As you can appreciate, you live in a community that's not previously had a rail station, is not accustomed to having live trains running through the community. There's a lot of safety information that one wants to impart. And so we've been doing that, as well as educating young people about courtesy on board trains and in stations when they ride and what's expected in terms of respect among passengers for one another. And so that's been a great opportunity. And we learned that the young people out there, particularly those that are not yet old enough to drive, are very excited about the train coming and wanting to ride, and they have destinations in mind already that they want to get to. excuse me, with respect to the place where we still have work to do, non-transit users in the region still have lower awareness than transit users. So you may recall that the ridership projections at the end of the first year of service are about 25,000 people each day. And if you go to the next slide, you can see where we expect those trips to come. So it's 25,000 people making 50,000 trips at the end of the first year. Now, a lot of those people, as Jim and the planners originally forecasted, are folks that are already today either taking the Orange Line or a bus connection to the Metrorail system or a bus to their ultimate destination. And so they'll be changing their habits. And as you know, for commuters, and you all represent them, habits are very hard to change on a daily commute. So that will come gradually. But my concern is also not only giving all these folks the information they need to make those changes, but also among non-transit users, giving them an opportunity and a reason and incentive to try using transit and leave that car parked at home. Northern Virginia is a very car-driven market. People love their cars. They like the individual control that their cars give them, their freedom to depart and arrive when they choose to, but they don't love traffic. And they are very, very gridlocked in many quarters with traffic. And so we think that that is probably going to be one of the, forgive the pun, driving forces behind people trying the Silver Line. On the next slide, you can see the ongoing outreach that we're doing, not only in Virginia, but also in Maryland in the district. We are talking about the hassle-free way that Metro allows you to travel more efficiently. You can sleep, talk, work, read. And it's often much more affordable when compared to the cost of gas, maintenance, and parking. In fact, we recently released our some sample trip times and the fare calculations based on new fares for these trips. And if you think about being able to come from Virginia downtown on a weekend to the Verizon Center for a game for, you know, between $3 and $4, you can't even touch parking for that. So the affordability of this transit method is quite persuasive, we think, for people. Shortly after Memorial Day, we started ramping up our efforts, and we have a schedule to be at more than 80 events at Metrorail stations, where we'll be distributing information at every station where the Silver Line will be added in terms of train service, and at every Blue Line station at least twice. This includes street teams where we try to get information into the hands of as many customers as possible, as well as pop-up events, which are a little bit more robust, where Metro staff go out and we engage people in question and answer and discussion to try to provide specific travel assistance to them. excuse me. In fact, today, I guess we were at Ballston, Federal Triangle, and Braddock Road stations. So if you have an interest in the festivals where we're going to be, the community activities, or even the stations, we're happy to share those schedules, and we're happy to have you join us and talk to folks. And I know that Loida has that and can pass it through the chair to the membership if that's of interest. This weekend, we're sponsors, and we'll be part of the Capital Pride event in the district, as well as the upcoming Celebrate Fairfax events at Reston Town Center. So you can also find us there and participate with us in those. We also have, and we hope you're getting these, and if you're not, we'll fix it, the Silver Bulletin, which is a weekly, people are shaking their heads, so it's coming to you, great, a weekly e-newsletter, goes out to more than 100,000 customers and stakeholders, opinion leaders in this marketplace. I will tell you it's been very effective for us. In the travel industry, we're told that between 10 and 15% of such e-newsletters get opened. Ours is above 30%, so we're more than twice what you'd expect on this, and I think that just is a testament to two things. One, the appetite that there is for information about the Silver Line, and the second is the talent of Gail Rebus on my staff, who's the editor of the newsletter. I think she's doing a terrific job. with respect to the fares and travel times, I briefed the media on Monday, and I gave them a few examples, and I'll share them with you because I think these, you know, they're just very real examples of what people can expect to find on the Silver Line. Some of you may have seen Adam Tuss's report a couple of weeks ago where he interviewed a woman called Rosa Williams. She travels every day from Hyattsville to Tyson's Corner. She drives in traffic through downtown D.C. and out to Tyson's on Route 66. So if you can imagine doing that trip twice a day, I mean, you know, it must be a great job, because I don't think that would be something I would do. But her new trip on the Silver Line will be some help to her, because it can take her from the West Hyattsville station on the green and yellow line to the Tyson's Corner station in 57 minutes. And we think that'll beat what her car's doing today in traffic. And it'll only cost her $5.90. It's a two-seat ride. She has to transfer at L'Enfant. But we think that's a pretty good deal, and hopefully that will make her the quality of her commute better. And she indicated to Adam that she was very excited about the train and ready to try it. And someone who lives in Reston today and works in the district, maybe near Farragut West, will be able to board the Silver Line at Wheelie Reston East and travel for 39 minutes and pay $5.90 in the peak on a weekday to get to Farragut. So that's a pretty good commute. And then you see my examples for McLean and to Gallery Place. But I would say this, and some of my colleagues here are in this situation, if you live in McLean and you're used to driving to a federal agency for your job every day and you get on the GW Parkway and you think it's going to take you 20 minutes, but it almost never does because of traffic and because you're one accident away from sitting for an hour. Well, now if you take the Silver Line from McLean, you'll be there in 32 minutes at L'Enfant and can comfortably walk to your job. So, again, that's about $4.85, and unless they're getting free parking, they're not getting parking cheaper than that. So we think this is going to be a very, very attractive offering for people, and we look forward to encouraging new ridership. If you look at the next slide, this is the information that's come around to you in the bag, may I? In these bags, the SilverLineMetro.com bag. So what we're giving out at all these events is the Silver Line brochure, the Blue Line brochure, the new rider guide, and then you get a little, I think I've given them to this council before, the glass wipes with a new Silver Line map on it. And these brochures talk in detail about station entrances, where you can find them, where there is parking and where there's not, kiss and ride locations, bicycle facilities, bus service, including options to the airport, and nearby businesses and attractions. The Blue Line brochure explains the service adjustments that are coming on the Blue Line to riders once the Silver Line opens, and talks Blue Line riders through their options for the fastest and most efficient way to reach their ultimate destination. I will tell you that we're seeing a shift on the Blue Line, and that my latest research shows that it has moved from people, making a decision about whether to take a blue or yellow train based on transfer to based on total trip time. And they are looking now at the revised PIDs and making a decision about which combination of trains is going to be fastest for them. And it's about 65% of the riders saying that that's the driver for them. So I think giving people information lets them make better decisions and lets them feel like they have choices. And while we don't have perfect solutions for Blue Line customers, and they will see a reduction in blue trains, they don't have a reduction in overall trains, so the more of them that choose the yellow combination with the transfer, the better. So we are encouraging that. Also, here in your presentation, and I won't take your time today to go through each thing, but I just wanted to highlight that we are doing profiles for each and every station so that people understand where they are located, what the landmarks are that are close by, what facilities each station has. You know, in the case of McLean, there's 26 bike racks, there's 20 rental bike lockers, there's a kiss and ride. There is, of course, no metro parking at these facilities because the planners early on in the communities that this service functions in wanted very much for it to be a catalyst for development for walkable, transit-oriented communities with mixed-use development. And so they were not planned to be regional intercept stations where people would drive from a long distance and park. These are planned to serve local communities. Yes.
Will there be Zipcar parking at any of these stations?
I'm not aware that Zipcar has done any specific deals, but if they do, it's likely to be maybe with developers along the line, with Tyson's or maybe with the LAS organization, which is the private entity that operates the parking lot out at Wheelie Avenue, Rest in East. And we would certainly like to see that. We have that adjacent to other stations. Jim, do you know? You heard any more on that?
There was a proposal, and Zipcar has been talking to Fairfax Connector to do something we would do. I don't know whether they have an agreement.
excuse me, Tyson's Corner is the other place where there is parking. Obviously, it's privately owned. As I've said, I don't know what Tyson's plans ultimately yet, what their final plan will be, but there are other shopping centers adjacent to other transit properties on the East Coast that have made a nice profit out of turning portions of their parking into commuter parking. There's a very small shopping center that's not far from where I live in Montgomery County that does that, that's connected to MTA buses. And, excuse me, you know, the shopping center would otherwise have a lot of empty parking during the day, but it's full up because they have a nice park and ride lot there. Excuse me, the Willowbrook Mall in New Jersey is my favorite example, but they for years had a parking facility there that turns a profit that it would otherwise go unused. So it may be that that some entities decide that there's a profitable reason to offer that, as well as will drive traffic to them. So I think we'll see as time goes on what the demand is. I'll leave it to you to read about Greensboro and Spring Hill and skip right over to the service, which is right here on the screen. Thank you. The same hours as the rest of the Metro Rail system, 5 a.m. to midnight on the weekdays, and then 7 a.m. to 3 a.m. on Saturdays. And so you'll see a train on the Silver Line every 6 minutes during the rush, and every 12 to 20 minutes at other times, so it's comparable to other lines. And the stations in the core that are serviced by Orange, Blue, and Silver will, when you see that overlay of the new Silver Line frequencies, see a train approximately every 3 minutes. So there are many, many people who board at many station locations who will see more frequent service, not just at the 5 new stations. On the next slide, we get into a little bit, this is what we've been sharing with our customers about Orange and Blue Line service. There are adjustments. Some people have come to understand Rush Plus service and have depended on that, but we have a change to Rush Plus service with the start of Silver Line service, as you can see here. And then, as we indicated on the Blue Line, there is 2 trains an hour will convert from blue. And so they'll see trains running about every 12 minutes over the course of the day. Again, for those who may not be familiar, there is a constraint of capacity in the Roslyn Tunnel. And so when you think about ways for the trains to get either over or under the Potomac River and into the district, we are at Metro quickly approaching the maximum capacity for tunnel use by putting trains through those tunnels around every 2 to 3 minutes. And so until momentum is funded and we can begin planning expansion, it's a zero-sum game with how many trains you can run a day. So when you add, you have to subtract or move a train, and that's what this plan has contemplated over many, many years. So now it's about educating our customers about where their trains are operating and how frequently they're operating and where their best opportunities are. So we will be out with our customers talking about Yellow Line options, talking about bus options, and reminding them of the new information that's available in the passenger information displays or PIDs, as well as talking to them through the use of our online tools, WMATA.com and SilverLineMetro.com and Planet Metro. Next will be an update of all of our online tools to include the Trip Planner, which will have Silverline options added to it just a couple weeks out from service starting, and because it does require the dates for you to be able to use that Trip Planner, and until those dates are set, we're a little bit constrained in that regard. And we'll be changing Metro alerts in our station kiosk screens and other at-a-glance service information as that date becomes available. So as we sit today, Metro is in control of the new part of the system of the Silver Line, Phase 1. That care and control passed to us a little more than a week ago. We have been actively training employees and testing on the line. It's going well. We had a security drill last weekend that involved many, many law enforcement and emergency management services, and that drill was to practice unified command in the event of an emergency, something that's very important in terms of responding. You don't want to be experiencing that for the first time when the fire alarm goes off. So, excuse me, that part of WMATA's plan is going as intended, We still have open items that we are awaiting from the contractor, from the Airports Authority, and we're reporting publicly every single week what the status of those open items are, and the next such report will be on Monday when we'll learn, you know, how many more items have been closed. General Manager has said that he looks forward to being able to say with confidence what the start date will be, hopefully sometime later this month. With that, I'd be happy, and Jim Hughes would be happy to take any suggestions you have for us or questions. Thank you.
Three things. First of all, I was riding the Metro and I saw the new Silver Line map today on a train, and I noticed that at the Reston Avenue stop, the Wheelie Avenue Reston stop, it doesn't list the airport buses. We have the listing for the 5A at L'Enfant, and at Roslyn, we have the B30 listed at Greenbelt, but there's no mention of how do you get to the airport from the end of the Silver Line.
On the map itself?
Yeah.
Good point.
And I noticed in some of the materials that were sent around before that at the Wheelie Avenue stop, the airport, the bus to the airport, and then the, whatchamacallit, that the airport authority runs,
The flyer,
thank you very much, mm-hmm. are at opposite ends of the pier. They should be next to each other on the pier. So riders can get off and look at one glance and see which is the next bus that's going to leave to the airport.
I see your point. Okay, thank you.
And there's a physical obstruction between those two ends of the pier, so you can't, like, see both of them at the same time. Mm-hmm. Makes sense, just put them together. In my new job in Roslyn, have to go on the one hop from Chinatown to Metro Center. I found that rather than transferring at L'Enfant, if I take that one hop on the red line, it saves me 5 minutes, both, you know, each way, every day. That is a very packed one hop. And it's going to get far worse when the Silver Line comes on, because more people are going to be transferring to that. So there's going to be a big effect on that one tiny bit of the red line as well. And I'm wondering if Metro has done anything to get ready for that. Ultimately, of course, this will be handled by the new connector that we hope to have, just a hallway between the two. So that's the very, very long-term solution. But I wonder if there's something that can be done about that in the near term. And then my final question is just, so you're going to be running Silver Line trains every 6 minutes, Blue Line trains every 12 minutes. If ridership on the Silver Line turns out to be lower than expected, would Metro be prepared to shift some of those trains back to the Blue Line?
I think that you have to give the Silver Line a chance.
Sure.
And so the point is to leave the service there so that the ridership develops. And so I think it's too early to say that there's any train operating plan that would be shifted. But that said, we always review ridership and demand and consider how to space trains as part of our operations planning. Do you want to add to that?
That's correct. And what we will probably see during the first year or so is not so much shifting of trains, but shifting of the consists of the trains. Where do we put our A-car trains? Where is the ridership? And be able to react to it if not as many people shift as we think we want to shift, or there's more, how can we respond? The easier way to respond is to shift the A-car trains, move them back and forth, to where the ridership is. And that's likely what you're going to see during the first year.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Just a little note. Ben is sort of standing in for Dan Turk, who is the chair of the committee that has a deliverable on the impact of the Silver Line. So what I want to do is to go to any other members of that committee. Catherine, do you have any questions? Because this is going to affect that deliverable.
No, I think having Ben speak for the committee is a pretty thorough way to go. No.
Okay.
And just as an advertisement, we are going to have a meeting on the impact of the Silver Line a week on Monday, actually, here at our usual time.
No, that's on buses.
No, it's going to be on the Silver Line.
Anyway. All right. We're so organized, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Okay. Let me then go back around. Mary Ann.
Just a question. I thought when there were some issues about when WMATA would take the Silver Line, one of the issues was around communications. How has that been resolved? How has that been resolved?
By communications, are you referring to the speaker wire issue?
Yeah. Or?
Yeah, so there are literally dozens of issues that are sort of punch list items that the contractor, Bechtel and Partners, is trying to close out. And with respect to the speakers in particular, that issue has been closed.
Going around, you have a question? Oh, okay. You're supposed to put up your nameplate, but that's okay.
I don't have a nameplate.
Yeah. There's one over there, but yeah. Anyway.
Thank you. I just want to echo the comment about the lack of information on the bus service to the airport. It's not on here either. I just want to. You mentioned that you expect 50,000 rides daily. How many new rides, riders? And what do you expect, what kind of annual increase do you expect in the future?
The first few years we projected a post-year standpoint of about 3% of the station. A lot of it is going to stem from the development that is happening around it. The station development is slower than we anticipated. We're sort of waiting for the line for the opening of the station. So we have to reach the building now.
No, that's okay. And in fact, last week the Reston Chamber had an event and they talked about 18 million square feet of new space in Fairfax along the Silver Line alignment is either up or going. So it's a fairly significant amount of development. So, yeah, you're finding that?
Yeah,
it's here, but it's not on the map. That's what they're saying.
Okay.
They'd like to see it on the map. So Jim's just pointing out the Washington Flyer information is on the brochure. It's just not indicated on the map, which is, I think, your point.
Yeah, right. I guess my last question is, how many, did you have to hire a lot of new people?
So there's been an increase in some police resources for the Silver Line, as well as train operators to operate the new service and station managers. For the five new stations. Are there controllers?
We've also hired some controllers. We've hired mechanics to deal with escalators, elevators, track mechanics, car mechanics, we're running more cars. Most of our mechanical workforce has been increased based on the amount of extra cars and car miles we're doing and to maintain the track that's out and the buildings that we're taking control of, yes.
Yeah. I just wonder how many new employees have you had to hire?
We could get back to you through the chair. We'll get back to you with the total number of employees.
Thank you.
Any other? Deborah.
I understand that Lynn was talking about tunnel capacity or tunnel safety. Can you explain a little bit more? You mean it looked like on the map, what page? You said what page? Silver Line impact through other rail service. Look like four different lines going through some of the same points, station point. Would that impact other train? It has to do with the threat. Can we explain a little more, maybe based on the technical or engineer point of view?
So Jim is really the expert in this, and I'm going to let him tell you. But basically, for trains to operate safely, the signal systems have to create a little bit of space in between them so they can get in, serve as a platform, move ahead, move in through the tunnel safely. And when you look at a two-track operation, which is what we have at Washington Metro, the tunnel under the river is one of the places where we have some capacity constraint because the number of trains coming over from Virginia is maxed out. Okay, that's the simple headline for you, but I'll let Jim talk a little bit more about how those trains are oriented to make it through the tunnel.
And it's not just the tunnel. Our two trains track system can handle approximately 26 trains an hour in each direction and operate reliably. That also includes the connection, because when you connect two lines together, there's a switch in between, and there's a time delay related to the switch. It's just like a merge on a highway. It takes a little bit more time to get through there. So our service plan is designed to have the headways that Lynn pointed out there, 6 minutes on the blue and the orange, and 12 minutes on the blue, excuse me, 6 minutes on the silver and the orange, and 12 minutes on the blue, gives us that capacity of bringing all those trains through Roslyn all the way through downtown and out to Stadium Armory on a headway that is less than every 3 minutes a train going through there. In order to get those trains, we did reduce the level on the blue line from the current 7 trains an hour down to 5 trains an hour, and that's why it's covered in the presentation. But when the trains merge at Roslyn, we will be operating 3 of our lines on those tracks. It's the only place we'll be doing that. There's not necessarily more trains. There's a little more confusion, some more people, and it'll take a little while for people to get used to it. But all the trains stop at all the stations, and so in the long run, it's going to be operated just like the blue and orange line has for years. There's just going to be another line integrated within it. Does that help? It's not going to impact how the trains operate. And actually, we think it's going to be a little bit more reliable in terms of what the customers see, because previous to by taking 2 of the blue line trains out, there's 2 less merges per hour. So the trains that continue through all the way from East Falls Church all the way through, they're following one another. And once the trains start to follow, the service becomes much more reliable. It's the switching coming in and out. And if there's any kind of delay at all of a train meeting its scheduled time departure, it sort of backs up the trains that are waiting for it. So we think there's going to be a little bit less than that. So we think overall the service will be more reliable.
I have one, and I can't find the place on the presentation, but you make a comment about people on the blue line may want to switch to buses. I think that's the hardest habit to change. People are usually, we were talking about day planners and saying people usually are tied into what they want if they're a rail rider. It's hard to get them to switch to buses and vice versa. So I think maybe there might be a good idea to do a little bit more specific, give some examples of what a person could do. You know, I think make it more, give more concrete examples. Like if you go, I think these examples are very dramatic and very good. And I think you need to give more about that particular suggestion you throw out, but just to sort of leave it hanging is.
Yeah, thank you. When we go to the Blue Line stations, we've actually made some big posters, blow-up posters, that have really, they're advertisements for the bus service, so that we show routes and we can walk people through their options. And I agree with you. I think it's harder to get somebody to move from train to train than it is to move from train to bus. But we sure are going to try. It has been a very slow process since Rush Plus to see any of that movement. But there are some great bus options. And, you know, I think people are reluctant because of traffic, again, to the reliability of a bus caught in traffic and the trip time that gets impacted by traffic. And so that's what drives the preference for rail. And so we're trying to give them the information, give them the choices. At the end of the day, it's the choice of the rider.
This is more of a comment as opposed to a question. My concern is that right now if there is, let's say, a sick passenger on the green line, it affects the yellow line. Same thing with the orange and the blue line. If you stick in a third line there, there's going to be major problems if just for a sick passenger, let's not even go into major operational problems. So has that been taken into consideration?
Sure, and in our communications and incident management protocols. We have considered those things. The more robust the service, the more frequent the service, the higher ridership the service has, the more that there are domino effects anytime a train stubs its toe. And so that is definitely something that we are managing for.
Will you be at a Fairfax, Delaware Fairfax? Because I'm thinking of going there too.
I will not personally, but my team will be. And if you're going to go, Deborah, I'll let them know to look out for you. Thank you.
There's been a bit of press lately about some of the new strip maps that involve the Silver Line and the fact that they're a little confusing, either because there's too much information on them or because of the alignment of some of the stop names as compared to the stop symbols. Are there any plans to either simplify or outright change those?
Yes and yes. some of what I've read is about mistakes on some of the signage that are being fixed. Okay, so hopefully those will all be corrected, the handful of mistakes where the line went here or the dot for the station covered the line or something like that and you know, it was a mistake. So the contractors fixed that. And that's underway. There is, I believe, coming to the Riders Advisory Council a proposed signage plan that would be, after thorough public discussion, implemented in phase two of the Silver Line, but the decisions for the design of those signs, believe it or not, even though it's phase two, have to be made over the next few months because of the lead time that's required. And so I've just seen the proposal. It's coming next to the RAC and to the AAC. There you go, Monday. So you are getting a very fresh look at a very new concept, and we appreciate your feedback on this because, frankly, you're seeing it before we've done any focus group testing, any research of any sort, and so you are the first of our ridership community to give us feedback on it.
Okay. One source of confusion on some of the existing maps, for example, is at Pentagon City, the strip maps include the Silver Line, despite the fact that the Silver Line doesn't go through Pentagon City. Is that the sort of thing that is likely to stay in place?
Tell me which map you mean, because I'm not sure I've seen that.
Yes. You know
where have you
seen
that?
Maybe you can describe it better than I can.
It's the horizontal ones along the walls.
The signage that's along the walls is very much part of the concept that you're going to see on Monday, a change to that.
Since we've got extra time, in the inevitable reaction from Blue Line riders, from other people who are impacted by all of this, is Metro prepared to make the case for momentum?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say we've been making the case for momentum for some time, since the board approved the strategic plan. We were very excited to celebrate the first investment in momentum that the two governors and the mayor made just a few months ago with a commitment of $75 million, which is a down payment on momentum. And I think that, you know, there's a real opportunity given the attention to the new Silver Line to make sure people understand, and I said this on a press conference on Monday, that this is the last fully funded expansion plan for Metro. The Silver Line is the last expansion we will see unless momentum is funded. It's really that simple. So a great opportunity to segue into that communication, and we hope that you will help us echo that message.
I just want to say, though, that in all of the cheery news about Metro, the message of the system is at capacity or beyond capacity might be lost. And I'm just a little concerned that you have to sort of triangulate between those two messages.
We have a very smart audience here in the nation's capital, and I think people can hold multiple ideas in their head at once. and the fact that Metro is making great progress in restoring safety and reliability, that we're growing ridership and expanding to new communities, and that we need more funding to continue to be the backbone of this region and of the region's economy. Those are three concepts that I think people are really starting to understand.
I just want to do a little setup for the next presentation, and it's sort of like kind of some additional information I think that the entire RAC should have. What the leadership team and the committee chairs have been doing is working very hard to, and along with a amount of staff who directly support us, but other staff, is to really try to align presentations with the work we've committed to ourselves and to the board to do. And it's in this, it's within this context that we're having this presentation that's called Metro's Fair Policy, but this is really related to the Budget and Finance Committee's work product of coming up with fare simplification. Fred Walker's not here tonight. He sort of didn't look at his calendar. He realized that he may have to go to his son's wedding tonight. He has a strange sense of priorities. But in any case, there are people who are here to represent the interest of the Budget and Finance Committee meeting, committee. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mark.
Thank you, Carol, and thank you to the rest of the council for having me here. For those who don't know me, I'm Mark Schofield. I'm the Director of Financial Planning and Analysis for Metro's Budget Office. I don't have a presentation per se to give. I think there were some talking points that Mr. Walker had put into the package that I think that you all got, and I think that will provide us a good place to begin just a discussion. I know that the interest is in coming up with some proposals regarding fare policy in general and simplification of the fares in particular. And I want to be here to have a discussion about that, offer my thoughts about it, and then offer my support. And if you all are going to be coming to us with some specific proposals, I want to provide the data that you need to look into those proposals and really try to try to understand what the impacts would be. I think it would be useful to talk a little at first just about what the board's sort of overarching policy principles are as far as fares, talk a little bit about what has happened the past two fare increases, and then just sort of kick off the discussion a little bit about whatever you all want to talk about. I asked Loida to include the board's resolution where they adopted the fare policy principles, which was back in 2010. And the principles, I think, are actually pretty good. There's some tension in the principles. It's very hard to come up with changes to fares that hit all of the principles. If you're trying to achieve one, you may run up against another one. And we have certainly found that the last few times that we've tried to change fares. I don't want to go through all seven of them. The third one in the list, optimize the use of existing capacity. This is one that we have found to be a real challenge recently. I mean, we do really want to encourage reverse commuting, encourage off-peak ridership, encourage all those sort of trips that aren't just the into the core in the peak commuting trips. But you end up with a couple different challenges. One is that often makes what is already a relatively complicated fare structure even more complicated. But then that last fare policy principle in the list for generating adequate revenue while maximizing ridership. A lot of whenever we look at certain changes, the result seems to be, oh, we're going to lose a good chunk of revenue with only a modest gain in ridership. And it's not so much that we can't do changes. I know that the view has been sometimes that we're resistant to changes. A lot of things we can do. There's a few things that probably technologically we couldn't do. We can do these things. It's just a policy question of, okay, where's the money going to come from that we're going to lose if we do this? And so that's what I want to be able to, again, I want to give you all the data as you look at different options to understand how many people are going to be affected, what the fares are that these people are currently paying, and given the proposed changes, what do we, and, you know, given some assumptions about the elasticity, how we think people would respond, what do we think the impact would be, both in terms of ridership and in terms of the budget, so that then we have a complete picture to decide whether this is the kind of proposal that we want to go forward with. Another one that I think in this same vein is the fifth one, facilitating the movement between the modes and the operators in the region. The transfer discount, you know, if you're transferring from bus to rail of 50 cents, has been at that level for a while. And I know there's been some people who have talked about trying to raise that. And again, that it's not something that we are opposed to. Again, I think it boils down to a money versus ridership question. And again, we'll be happy to support looking into that again. I just want to be, I don't want to claim that there's a silver bullet there that's going to make that easy to do. And then the sixth one is an interesting one, encouraging the use of cost-effective media. You know, we previously, a couple fare increases ago, you know, on rail, the price for Smart Trip and paper was the same. Then we added a 25-cent surcharge per trip if you were using paper. That had a little bit of an impact on usage. Then in FY13, we upped that to $1 per trip. That had a substantial impact on moving people over to Smart Trip. We still, even after that, had about a 10% usage of paper. But now that we've lowered the cost of the Smart Trip card down to $2, so that essentially if you're making a round trip, Smart Trip is you know, the way to go. If you're making a round trip or anything more, that's the way to go. I was just looking at the numbers from April this year and April last year, which is a very tourist-heavy month, and we have already seen a couple percentage point drop in the use of paper from 14% down to 10 or 11%. So I think that pricing change is already driving. But so that's on the rail side. On the bus side, if you were watching the fare increase that we just had that's going to go into effect June 29th, we actually sort of went the opposite direction for bus this time around. You know, we used to have a cash surcharge for bus, and now we have the same price for cash and for Smart Trip on bus. The feeling there is that cash surcharge was not really the driver for pushing people over to Smart Trip. The driver on the bus side is you get the free transfer when you use Smart Trip, and that the 7-day bus pass, which is really one of the only pass products we have that is heavily used, that pass product is only available on Smart Trip. And that those two things put together are really what drives the usage of Smart Trip on bus. That still was a discussion point as we went through the fare discussions, and people said, well, aren't you sort of going against what one of your policy principles here is? And on the bus side, one of the reasons to push to Smart Trip is for loading people onto the bus so that people are just, you know, getting on, going tap, 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 walking on, not fumbling with cash at the fare box. One of the issues that we do have on the bus is people loading very low amounts of cash so that they get the Smart Trip fare. So, you know, they're only putting $2 on their card. So that ends up being a long transaction as well. Our feeling is that anyone who might currently be using Smart Trip, who is going to decide to go back to cash now that the prices are the same, that's very likely to be those very same people who are making those cash transactions at the fare box already. So from an operational perspective, we're not terribly worried that this is going to hurt the bus any more than it's already being hurt by those folks doing those transactions. We will definitely be watching the data, though, once the fare change goes into effect. You know, cash usage on bus is only at about, is now down to, I don't know, 5 or 6% of trips. So we'll be watching that to see if that changes significantly at all. Sorry, I sort of went off on a tangent there. So I asked Loida to provide you guys with some of the information from the FY13 fare change. I was not here for that, but I know all the information pretty well. In that fare change process, the board was very interested in sort of going back to square one and saying, well, what if we looked at flat fares? What if we looked at zone fares? What if we looked at a number of other kinds of options? And so some of that information was in there. Ultimately, obviously, they decided not to go that direction. They did make the decision, however, to do away with the peak-of-the-peak charge that we had previously instituted in fiscal 2011, which was very unpopular with customers and which didn't even achieve the purpose which was to try to push people off into the shoulders of the peak. A lot of folks told us, you know, due to their work schedules, their school schedules, whatever, I can't move. And they felt targeted by that in a way that, you know, that they couldn't react to. So that was something that in that previous fare change that the board did away with. In the FY15 fare change that we just finished, I would certainly characterize it as a very sort of incremental maintenance level fare change. There were not any big sort of conceptual changes that happened. The fare changes are essentially just going to generate a little bit more money. I think there is certainly an appetite, especially once NEP is past the pilot phase and into development, and the pilot phase is due to begin in January. I think there will be more of an appetite at that time to potentially go back to square one again, at least, you know, especially if we have some new people on the board, just because we have the opportunity technologically with NEP to do some different things, to again consider zone fares, flat fares, reverse commute fares, probably a number of the sort of things that you guys are thinking about. So I think this process can be sort of leading up to that. So with that, I just want to, you know, sort of narrowly, I want to be a data resource as you begin to come to some concepts that you want to examine in more detail. I'd rather not provide you like just a huge dump of data, but if you have a more sort of narrowly targeted data request, that's absolutely something that we can support. But then also if you just have sort of policy level questions, I'd be happy to do that as well. So
I have a question. I'm curious as to what the thinking was about the flat fare when it was looked at in 2000.
I wasn't here,
right.
But any question of the flat fare gets tied up in the sort of jurisdictional realities of the Metro Compact and the way that the subsidy is allocated and all that. Round number, you could generate the same amount of revenue with a flat fare of $3 and something, $3.25, $3.50, something like that. But you would be, you know, riders in the district would be paying substantially more than they are now. Riders from Fairfax or Shady Grove or someplace like that coming into downtown would be paying substantially less. So that would cause political issues. You might be able to address that by changing how the operating subsidy is allocated, but that would be a very tough nut to crack as well. Again, not saying it's impossible, but you would need to find some sort of a quid pro quo, I think, for that. So.
Patrick?
Yeah, I wanted also to point out the improvements we made on Metro Access. I thought reducing that fare from $7 to $6.50 was great. Appreciate all the work that was done by everyone on that and yourself on that score. I think the other thing that was important, particularly on the Metro Access side, was that over the next 2 years, a substantial study is going to be done on looking at the root causes for paratransit and how can it be improved, so that we're looking at how we can move people maybe not off of paratransit, but give them more choices as far as the fixed route system. And in particular, taking individuals or taking the jurisdictions, particularly the medically based transportation that has been dumped, sort of moved onto paratransit, and perhaps move that back to the jurisdictions so that the paratransit system is not overloaded. So there's a lot of work to be done. I know that the AAC appreciated the reduction in the peak fare from $7 to $6.50, but what I was most impressed with was the work that the board did in trying to understand the root cause of why a paratransit system could potentially get overloaded and looking to fix root causes of the problem rather than just work at it from a fair policy standpoint. That was well done.
I would just follow that up. We are in the middle of discussions right now with the district regarding the pilot program to move kidney dialysis patients over to taxi cabs as a more cost-effective way to get those folks to their doctor's appointments. And I think the work that is going to be going on sort of jointly between Metro and the jurisdictions, hopefully to improve bus stop access, will allow folks who maybe could use the bus if they had a clear, safe path to the bus stop and not have to use Metro access. I think that will also pay some benefits.
I have a few comments. About your point about district riders paying more at the flat fare, I know that in Paris they kind of have a distance ring, and so anyone within the ring pays a flat fare, and then if you go outside you pay more. Is that something that's been considered?
Yeah, we have looked at zone fares. I think something like that would have a much better chance of at least being considered than a purely flat fare. I mean, the nature of the system being sort of a hybrid commuter rail and subway system makes it really hard, I think, to do a flat fare. But yes, if you were to say take, you know, the diamond of the district in Arlington and Alexandria and have that be an inner zone and then have everything else be an outer zone, not that there wouldn't. Well, and I mean, I'm speaking purely conceptually here. Purely conceptually.
Allow me to be clear. You have an escort to get out of here.
Yes, no, but I mean, and there's always, you know, you. No matter where you draw the line, you end up with a station that is either just over the line one way or the other, and these are very big challenges. But doing a one or two or three zone system, not one, sorry, a two or three zone system would certainly have a much a better chance than a pure flat fare, I think.
Yeah, I was just going to follow up with a comment just about I think that the difficulty in fare calculation is probably one of the number one barriers for new riders, and I think that the chart is incredibly intimidating. I've spoken to countless people, especially new visitors to the city, who get to the chart and in the airport and then just take a cab. And I just wanted to just really make that point that I think that it's just a little bit prohibitive in its complexity at this point.
When we roll out the new fares on the 29th, we will have made one change, which is, you know, now it shows the smart trip fare and then it says add a dollar if you're using paper. It'll be the other way around now. It will show the paper fare and then say take a dollar off if you're using smart trip because the people – Carol's shaking her head at me.
I think that's confusing. But,
well,
you know. But go on.
This is, I mean, I have been out there for the cherry blossoms and the 4th of July and for other, you know, when we've had station closures. And, the people who tend to be using that are the people who are visitors, who are, intermittent users, the people who are most likely to be paying the cash fare. Mm-hmm. The paper fare. Mm-hmm.
So I think as a short-term measure, I think that's the right thing to do. We are on track in the next 18 months-ish to potentially be out of the paper business entirely. So that issue will go away. Then the fare will be the fare. But we'll cross that bridge in a little bit. I think I agree that not just the fare table. I mean, again, when I've been out there helping customers for the big events and stuff, if you step back and look visually at those machines, they can be very overwhelming. No sense dancing around that. It would be great if you had a touch screen or something where you could say I am here and I'm going here, but that's a long way down the road. So.
Ben.
Thanks for coming, and thanks especially for your offer to provide data. I think this is the first time in my years on the rack that any Metro employee has actually said, we're here to provide you some data. So here's the data that I'm interested in.
Maybe I should rescind that offer. Is that no?
Yeah. Here's the data that I'm interested in, because I've heard a lot of speculation about this, and I'm interested in learning what this is. So thinking about it in terms of supply and demand, there is what I'll call the death spiral point, where Metro raises the fares so high that riders don't arrive anymore and Metro can no longer sustain itself. And then there's the other end of the spectrum, maybe you'll call it a heavenly spiral point or something like that, where Metro lowers the fares so much that it makes rail ridership in particular so attractive that people glom onto the system and overcrowd it, and then the system becomes unworkable. Where are we on that spectrum? Are we closer,
heaven or hell?
Right. Are we, because there's been a lot of speculation that we're getting close to that death spiral point, that fares are rising higher and higher, and all of a sudden there's going to be nobody on Metro. But at the same time, you also see packed cars and things like that. So where are we on that spectrum?
Speaking only for myself, I think in the past we have been able to raise rail fares easily and not have much loss in ridership, partly due to the transit benefit that so many of our riders have, and partly due to just the general terribleness of trying to drive down into the district, whatever. But you are at a point now where if you're coming from a suburban location, especially if you're doing park and ride, you're at $15 a day easily. And we've been having a lot of issues with the transit benefit. It's currently at 125, 130, whatever the number is. Not clear that it will get back up to the higher level that it was at before. So I don't want to say that we're in any sort of spiral, but I think we have to be more careful perhaps than we've been in the past about raising fares, because when you're at that $15 level, it may look, you may be on the margin and say, well, I'm just going to drive. I think we're seeing, the opposite thing on the bus. Well, not the opposite thing exactly, but we're seeing a bus market develop that didn't exist as much before either. We're seeing, I say this all the time, but, up 16th and 14th and, Georgia and 7th. I mean, we're seeing ridership on those routes really just grow and grow and grow among people who might have other options. They're choosing to take the bus because the service is good and because it's low priced. They could potentially walk over to the yellow or green line and take that, but they don't need to. I think you have to think a little differently about the rail and the bus systems. So I don't know if I answered your question or not, but
you've gave a better answer than I've ever heard. So that's getting to the other place.
Well, I don't know what you started off by asking about the data. I don't know what our data would necessarily show you on that. What would you?
Where is the point where fares get too high, and where is the point where fares get too low? And how close are we on either spectrum? Obviously, it's difficult when you don't have a flat fare that you adjust one way or the other when there are so many combinations. But as a sort of ecosystem, and maybe even just take rail, for example, where is that spectrum? I'm sure there's some way to, you know, some formula to put that in. Just a thought.
Yeah. I mean, again, I would say, you know, in the past, the elasticity of our riders in response to fare increases has been very, very low, you know, 0.1. Do I think it's now probably a little higher? Is it more, you know, 0.2 or 0.3? Yes, I do. That's still pretty inelastic. And I think as long as we're raising fares in a sustainable manner, I think we'll be okay. I personally, and this is just, I'm off on a little tangent here, but my concern for our ridership middle distance is less about the price and more about, honestly, telework and telecommuting. Even if you don't go to the office once a week even, that's 20% of the trips that you would normally make. And the feds are pushing telework very hard. It used to be sort of a carrot that they would offer to employees. Hey, if you want to work at home, sure, go ahead. It's turning into a stick that GSA and OMB are using when leases come up for government agencies. They're saying, you know, we're cutting your leased space in half. You have to have people working at home 2 and 3 days a week. That's not something that happens overnight. Leases don't come up all that often, but it slowly. So as DC grows and as it becomes more attractive, as there are more jobs and more people, that's a positive force. But changes in travel behavior, I think, are potentially a downward force. That's not something we have our arms around all the way yet. And it's something that I'm trying to look into more. So.
And just one parting comment. I'd be interested to hear what the other RAC members think about the sort of spectrum between simplicity of fare structure and equity of those fares. I, for one, am much further on the equity side. I would much rather pay less, and I would rather have the fares tailored to, you know, where people are coming from, rather than have a simple fare. Simple fares are great for visitors, but visitors are only 5% of Metro's riders. You know, there's a trade-off there, and I think the vast majority of people who ride Metro are on the equity side rather than on the simplicity side, but that's just me. I'd be curious to hear what other people think about that.
Yeah, I'd like to respond to that, but I want to get to people. James.
How you doing?
Good.
Fare simplification, best practices. Washington is, there are two cities that I think of that have systems in terms of geography that are comparable to what Washington has. Philadelphia, because Philadelphia's system, I believe, services New Jersey and Delaware. And New York City, I believe, services New Jersey and I believe Connecticut. I don't know. Do you look at best practices when you consider fare increases, and do you look at metropolitan areas such as this and to see what they do?
I actually, since this was on Mr. Walker's notes, I did a little bit of research on best practices as far as fares. And there's not a lot of research out there as far as policy guidance. There's a lot out there in terms of technology. And I think if we're successful in the NEP deployment, I think we'll be at the forefront in terms of best practices for methods of paying fares. But I think policy is such a locale-specific question. And it's a lot of it is just historical. I mean, the other major rail system that charges like we do is BART in San Francisco. They were created at about the same time that we were. MARTA in Atlanta has the ability to do distance-based fares because they have tap-in and tap-out gates. They don't choose to do that. They at the moment have a flat fare. But I think we all sort of came about later, you know, in the 60s and 70s, when distance-based charging was possible, whereas for Philly and for New York and Chicago and Boston, it just wasn't possible when they were created. And you have this sort of historically dependent path that things sort of went along. You know, you have places like Chicago that have mandated cost recovery ratios. I believe in Chicago, when I was in Chicago, which was a while ago now, I believe it was 50%. So which is, ours is a little higher than that right now. When you combine rail and bus, it's about 52-54%, something like that. But that's mandated by the legislature. So if they look, if it looks like they're going to come in under 50% fare box recovery, they are mandated to either raise fares or cut service. I don't think that's something that we would like to be looking at. I think it really is a very sort of, I think it's just sort of our regional policy preferences. I don't know that there's a lot as far as that aspect of that we look to other places for.
Candace.
My question is actually in regards to the bus fares.
Yes,
and the fact that there was no increase and there was a decrease, and what that sort of does to, I guess, creating revenue for us to buy additional buses and for us to do the things that I guess were supposed to be done over the next few years, like increase service on 16th, increase service on 14th, increase service on Georgia Avenue. What happens to those things now that we didn't have an increase in fare and we actually have a decrease in fare?
Sorry if I wasn't clear. The Smart Trip, so the Smart Trip and the cash fares are now the same.
Right.
So it was $1.60 and $1.80.
Right.
It will now be $1.75 for both. So most people will be paying more in fare.
Okay.
So I would expect that our fare box recovery on the bus is about 25%, meaning we cover about 25% of our expenses from fares. I think that will stay about the same. It might tick up a tiny bit. As far as buying buses and things like that, that's all coming out of the capital budget rather than out of the operating budget. So our ability to do that is going to be dependent on, you know, the momentum and the Metro 2025 efforts, getting the funding for that. We are in the process. I don't need to go into the details, but we have a capital funding agreement that we have with the jurisdictions that is going to be expiring soon. We'll be renegotiating that with them. That will, again, put us on track for the next 6 years to continue replacing the existing buses, you know, doing all that. So those, the fares versus the buses is a little bit of a separate discussion.
Okay. To comment on what Ben asked about, I'm going to call it between Heaven's Gate and Hell's Gate. Two things. One is, I had this wild and crazy idea that maybe the entity that we should be looking at is a change in the jurisdictional contribution. In other words, maybe the jurisdictional contribution formula should be adjusted to maybe take care of some of this tension between low fares and high fares. That's one thing. And then the second thing is, if I understand the equity analysis that you all worked on for a good portion of this year, it sort of locks you into some almost caps on fare increases, if I understand it correctly, under Title VI, or is that being overly simplistic?
We just can't do anything to it. If you boil it down, we can't do anything because the bus ridership is more low income and more minority.
Mm-hmm.
If we try to stick it to the bus riders too much more than we're doing it to the rail riders, we will not be able to pass the equity analysis.
Right. If
they're both sort of raising together,
mm-hmm.
that's fine. If you're doing the same thing to everybody,
mm-hmm.
then you could do a little increase or a huge increase as long mm-hmm. as everybody's getting hit the same amount.
Okay. And as I said, I mean, you know, my impression was that there was a bottom line number.
Well,
for the subsidies, and even though you all had to go back and make adjustments because of the delay in the opening of the Silver Line and some other things, that bottom line figure that was asked of the jurisdictions never did really change. The numbers numbers changed. You know what I mean? But the bottom line number never changed. So I'm assuming that there's some political small p. pressure to keep the subsidies kind of constant, or there's some agreement saying we're not going to spend more, we're not going to ask the jurisdictions to get up off of more than this amount of money. And so therefore everything else has to be adjusted to come to that number, but maybe that's my paranoid theory of history.
I think if we, how do I say this? There are sort of two different things that you could be talking about. Looking at rail, for example, our fare box recovery on rail is about 75%. Mm-hmm. You could say, on the one hand, we want to keep the same structure that we have now, roughly distance-based, time-based, everything like that, but we just want fares to be lower. We want the fare box recovery to only be 50% on rail. But okay. You could keep the subsidy out so that the total subsidy that the jurisdictions would have to pay would definitely go up. Okay. But the subsidy allocation would be the same.
Got it.
You could do that. That would just be sort of a general lowering of the fares, but not changing any of the other stuff. Or you could do, if you were to go to a zone fare or a flat fare or something, where there would be sort of real disparate jurisdictional effects, where, long distance commuters might be paying much less, folks in the district might be paying much more. Then I think you would have, like I said, I think you would have to crack open the subsidy allocation itself to have any chance of that working, because otherwise it's a zero-sum game, and you know what I mean? And so there's the level, and then there's the structure.
Are you the right person I can talk to? Can I ask you about the Parker guys with the list of fare information instead of looking for the fares on the vending machine?
I'm probably, unfortunately, not the right person. Can we pass that information through, perhaps, to
Deborah,
question through?
I didn't understand.
She has the pocket guide to fares.
Okay.
Which is not my area of expertise.
Okay. Well, why can't you add that to other duties as a
Yeah, son? Sure.
Yes, you need a new pocket guide.
Yeah, with a fare structure on it. When people want to ride one, I'm
going
to have to pay.
Oh, I see. The issue.
I've been looking for the pocket guide with the fare information for each one of their destinations. I only see only city on the vending machine.
I see. They would have to be station specific. You would have to print 86 of different brochures.
No, they
would
just. They used to be handouts of an
86 by 86? Really? Okay.
They used to have it years ago, but I remember.
Okay.
Interesting. Well, this is a conversation that could go on and on. And I really thank you for coming here. Oh, I'm sure. Sorry, public comment before I do my wind-up.
So I just wanted to point out as well, since you sort of opened the door or the window a crack by pointing out sort of tinkering with the subsidy formula, one of the other things that's been very successful, especially for some of the mass transit systems in Asia, MTR in Hong Kong really comes to mind, is value capture from real estate. Now, of course, MTR's case is sort of special because they've got a lot of land. With WMATA, sort of the genie's out of the bottle already, and most of that land's already gone. The system was built so long ago that, there's still plenty of land left, but not quite as much, and I doubt it would ever be as much of a revenue source. But that's certainly something to think about because, otherwise, if you go back to, say, for example, Montgomery County, where I live, and you say, increase the subsidy, well, that either means taking money away from roads, which will make people scream, or raising taxes, which will also make people scream. I think that's rather unfortunate, especially when you actually show people what is spent on roads versus what is spent on transit. It's rather disproportionate. But to the extent that there are other sources of funding that may be neglected or not given quite as much attention as they could, anything to avoid having to touch, tinkering with the subsidy formula, because that's just such a, believe me, I would love to see the jurisdictional subsidy raised. I'd pay higher taxes if that's what it took, absolutely. But selling that to my neighbors in Up County, Montgomery County, where it's more rural and up in the agricultural reserve, they're not going to like it. And, you're going to see that in Virginia as well, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. And I have to, again, give credit to Ben for this, because Ben came up to me a couple of meetings ago and said, how come WMATA didn't look, you know, didn't adopt any of our recommendations, I think, except one? And I think by getting a jump on this, in other words, this is the year for the Riders Advisory Council to have its shot at making significant input to the process so that it could, you know, if we come up with a deliverable on fair simplification, it can be folded into whatever work is done during the next year for the 2016 budget, right?
For fiscal 2017.
Okay. So, thank
you. What do you think our process will be as far as data requests? Will they all come through either to you or to Fred?
You will not get 21 or 19 requests. No, what will happen is that Ben, no, that's not right. Fred, no, I'm Fred is the chair of the Budget and Finance Committee. He's supposed to listen to this session or take notes, and what he's going to do is he'll be the one funneling questions. So if you all have any questions, you can email them to Fred and copy me. If something's okay, thank you again.
Sure.
And at this point, we will. Yes. Okay. Loiter has just given me a note, and I think that this is more important because I want people to get out of here before the first thunderclap goes on. So what I'm going to do, unless somebody really has a problem with this, is to do a couple of things. Number one, I'd like to hear a motion on moving our July RAC meeting from the 2nd to the 9th. Any discussion? Call the question. All in favor? Thank you. The other thing we need to do, all in favor? I'm sorry, that was my fault. Any opposed? Abstentions? Okay. The other thing is that I'd like to, as we saw last month when people kind of went into their own separate committees of choice, there was only one person in security and safety, and we need a motion to delete that committee, at least for this year. So would somebody make such a motion? Aldea?
No, go ahead.
Move to delete safety and security?
It's going, the functions are going to be, yes, I'm sorry, I shouldn't. It's not deleted. The function of the safe.
Customer service.
That's my fault. That's because that's exactly what I said. Second?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? Call the question. All in favor? Opposed?
Oh, wait. Do you need it again? No. Oh, no.
In favor? Opposed? Abstentions? Okay, and then what we really need to discuss, too, and I know I'm going against the agenda that we reviewed and approved, is on Monday, June 9th is a big RAC day. From 12 to 1, the leadership team will be having a meeting by teleconference. So if you all want to participate in that, please email me and you'll get the phone number for the teleconference. Then at 5 p.m. on Monday, June 9th, there will be a joint meeting of the Riders Advisory Council and the Bus Rail Subcommittee of the AAC, and the presentation will be on signage. And I just found out the urgency of the presentation by what Lynn said. I know that that's not the ideal time for members of the RAC to attend, but it is the regular meeting of the Bus and Rail Subcommittee, and it's much more difficult for them to adjust their time because of metro access schedules, et cetera. So I would really like to get a preliminary show of hands of people who will be able to attend that meeting. And there will be food at the end. I know people are coming from work, and there will be another meeting, so basically food will be served at 6 o'clock. So with that in mind, how many people can come? No, it's 5 to 6. And I have to say that the AAC starts its meetings on time, so don't think if you can come 5 or 10 minutes late, they don't play with their agenda. So the meeting actually starts at 4 p.m., but the portion that's joint for the presentation is going to be start promptly at 5. So how many people are going to be able to come to the meeting? Okay, can you take down a name? Okay.
Can you send the presentations for that ahead of time so we can comment as necessary before?
Yeah, because it sounds like now there's a presentation. See, there wasn't one when this meeting was set up. Okay, so you all have the numbers. Okay, and if you change, in other words, because food has to be ordered in, so please let me know. And as I said, I would really appreciate people making a special attempt to make this meeting so it can really be a bona fide joint meeting. And the reason that this was set up like this is the signage committee obviously is anxious to talk to both groups, and it just makes sense for them to do it to the two groups together. So is that it for that? Okay, so I think we're now back on our agenda. And I think I don't have anything to say with the chair report that's not already written. You have the chair report that I did to the Metro Board, and I think I gave you an addendum, so I have nothing further to add to that. I know I'm going to come back to the committee meetings. I want to get Loida, who has an update on the hiring of the RAC staff coordinator. And before I turn it over to Loida, according to my notes, we should have a field trip to both Paris and some part of Asia to do our job most thoroughly.
So I have good news. I have good news on the update. So we have extended an offer that is contingent upon the background check and a salary approval from HR. So unfortunately, at this time, I cannot give you the candidate's name just because it's something spending, but I wanted to make sure that I share that with you to let you know what's moving ahead. I hope to have something concrete to share with you in the next week. Any questions? Yes. I don't know, but as soon as I know, I will let you know. Because by the time that it comes back and they formally accept, and they will have to give notice, I guess it's probably going to be July, beginning of July. Because we also have to, I don't know if you know this, but the new employee orientation happens every 2 weeks. So they have to start on one of those Mondays. So there's a week that we lose because of that.
Okay, moving right along. celebrate John. Okay. You're right. That's what it was. It was intentional. It was intentional.
Carol, I do have one update I forgot to tell you. I looked up the number of positions for the Silver Line, and it's 363 new positions that were added to support the Silver Line. Mr. Fogel.
And at this point, I'm going to call for the committees. Is there any report from Budget and Finance? As I said, Fred Walker couldn't be here, so, okay. Customer Service and Tom Dreff's in here, so we don't have one from him. And Governance, Karen Lynch couldn't be here because of a family emergency, and we did have a bylaws meeting, a Governance Committee meeting. We did go through the bylaws. She will be putting them out in marked up form, and she did consider all of the suggestions that were made, so you will have a chance to see it in marked up fashion and make additional comments, suggestions, and input. Ben, do you have anything for the planning program and projects?
Yes, Speaking for Dan Turk. Monday after this other meeting.
Right.
there will be a Triple P meeting. I think we're planning at 6. Yeah, so 6 here. We're going to go into, across the way. Okay. The other side of the courtyard.
Yeah, that's
there.
Where the food will be for the people who attended the other meeting.
There you go. So we'll kick over any food that's left over. And then we're going to go deep into the weeds on the effects of the Silver Line, talking about train capacity, 8-car trains, electricity issues, all sorts of stuff that you want to know about effects on the Blue Line, what can be done for Blue Line passengers. This is sort of our deliverable that we'll be working on. So please join us.
Then I'm totally confused, but I won't take up the time of the meeting because I thought Jim Henry was going to be talking.
No, that's later.
Okay.
He is confirmed to be coming on Monday. That was the direction. That was the direction that I got from.
All right. So, yeah, so we'll be talking about 16th Street and how that will work. Yes.
Okay. Maybe it can be done. Maybe it's going to be a small meeting, so maybe we can do it from 6 to 7:30. If you did it from 6 to 7:30, you could split the time, maybe.
Yeah, we'll make it happen. Anyway.
Anything else? Any announcements? Anything else for the? I had a boss who used to say for the good of the order. I never knew quite what it meant, but it sounded good.
I have a question. Did I hear right that you already have a list of the events for the Silver Line, the 80 events? Do you already have that?
Shared it with you about 2 weeks ago, and I will share it again.
Maybe
because we get biweekly updates. So the last time I got it, I shared it.
Packet.
Yep.
Okay. Sorry.
It's a very extensive list. It's long.
Okay. So yeah. Can you send it out again? Because it seems to have gotten lost in a lot
sure.
of mail.
We'll include it on Friday again.
Is that the same as the community events?
Mm-hmm.
Different?
It's
the same.
Okay.
It has both the pop-ups and the community events.
Okay.
Marianne.
Just a question. I guess I'm assuming that the customer service is still planning a meeting on the 17th of June?
Yes.
Okay.
No, I'm running the customer service committee. I'm not on that. I mean, if you want to give... I swear, I wasn't there. I've been here a lot, but I wasn't at that meeting. Okay. Anything else? We're actually within a minute of actually ending 15 minutes early. Let's not spoil a good thing here.
A question. I'm curious. Are we going to be able to take a part in the grand opening of Silver Line?
That is definitely on our list. Okay. In other words, what we're asking about, what we've asked the WMATA staff to look at is. Getting a ride on the Silver Line before it officially opens, and also to get a ride on the 7000 series car before they are officially put into service or something like that. So that is on the agenda for the RAC.
That's if we don't go to Paris or Singapore.
That's right. If we don't go to Paris or Singapore, then, yeah. Hong Kong, right. Okay. Can we adjourn? Thank you.